Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of one reality that we see underneath them.
Oh, yeah, you bet. And this is episode number 41. And we are going to talk about a movie called Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Which surely everybody has seen.
most people. But before we get into that, I just wanted to mention that we've gotten several excellent notes about The Stand. So thanks everybody for writing in.
Definitely.
And we easily could have done another hour on The Stand. So my next book selection is going to be The Stand.
And then I'm going to pick The Stand.
Yeah, we both realized after we finished talking for, I think it was like an hour and 20 minutes, hour and a half, we hadn't even gotten to Nick in the stand. And anyway, so we stopped for time reasons, but boy, we could have spoken a lot more about that book.
Maybe next time we have a long one, we'll do a two-parter or something like that.
Yeah, maybe we could do that. Maybe we could record 2 hours or something and then release them episode 40 A and B or something.
Yeah, or something. So it's not so scary when it shows up in
Holy cow, yeah. I've seen like four-hour podcasts before.
Yeah.
Well, you know, which is great if they're like an audiobook, but if it's just you and me talking, you'd think somebody had shut it off.
That would scare me, much less other people.
But anyway, thanks everybody for listening. And, you know, really nice notes. Really appreciate it. And lots of thoughtful stuff, too.
Oh, yeah. Really thoughtful comments. And some great book ideas, books I've never heard of. And, I just want to say, for me personally, the idea of somebody walking along the Rhine for their evening stroll, listening to Scott and me talking about The Stand, it doesn't take much to get me all going, and I got a real rush out of that. So thank you for that.
Made my day, too. Thank you very much. You bet.
Yes.
So episode 41 is now, and we're talking about Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou, which is a Coen Brothers movie. From what year? Not too long ago. About 2000, I think it was.
2000, I think, because... Yep. I have Roger Ebert's review here. Yeah, 2000.
The year 2000. I have Roger Ebert's review here as well.
Oh,
and just because when I looked at his review, you and I had spoken a little bit this week, not too much, but just a little bit, and we mentioned Fargo, and then I mentioned that I had read somewhere that in Fargo it said, I remember at the beginning it says based on a true story, and then later the Coen brothers said, well, maybe not.
Yeah.
So what does based on mean anyway? But it seems to have had no basis in fact whatsoever.
Inspired by a dream I had one night.
Yeah, so I really don't understand their purpose in putting based on a true story there. But that's almost a different argument. But the reason that's come up is because, let me just read the first paragraph of Roger Ebert's review. It says, the opening titles, and this is a review of Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou, by the way, not Fargo. The opening titles inform us that the Coen brothers' Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou is based on Homer's The Odyssey. The Coens claimed their Fargo was based on a true story, but later confided it wasn't. This time, they confessed they haven't actually read The Odyssey. Still, they've absorbed the spirit. Like its inspiration, this movie is one darn thing after another. And I had to laugh because the reason that I picked this movie is because Jesse and I over at SFF Audio, we just finished reading The Odyssey. And I thought, oh, how cool. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? One of my favorite movies. And it's based on The Odyssey. And now that The Odyssey is so fresh in my mind, won't it be cool to rewatch that with The Odyssey fresh in my mind? And I watched it and I was like, boy, this really doesn't have a lot to do with The Odyssey. That was my thought.
That was my reaction as well.
Uh-huh. So
I was watching going, why is Penelope acting like this?
Yeah, why? Penny, who is played by Holly Hunter, is nothing like Penelope in the Odyssey. So, you know, there's some names going on. Ulysses Everett McGill is the main character. And there are a few things like Cyclops and Siren mm-hmm. scene. And the one darn thing after another, I think, is the closest thing that comes, you know,
right.
These guys go through a lot of stuff just yep. trying to get home. But the Odyssey is about homecoming and it's about marriage.
Right.
And this movie is not about those things at all. It doesn't really share a thematic. It may share a storytelling structure, which is what I think Roger mm-hmm. Ebert is saying. But it doesn't really share anything theme-wise, in my opinion.
Right. We looked it up as well using our favorite source, Wikipedia. So it may vary a little bit. But, it, you know, on this kind of stuff, it tends to be fairly accurate. And mm-hmm. they were saying that of the six people who worked on the script, one person had read the Odyssey. He was a Harvard man, evidently. And but what the Coen brothers liked were all the tributes and parodies and all those things where it's just like you and Jesse had been saying, wow, you think you know the Odyssey until you sit down and read it and you go, this isn't exactly what I thought.
Yeah, and it wasn't. When I read it this time,
more connected. Yeah.
There was a lot of things that I discovered about the Odyssey that I did not know before.
Right.
And even having read it in the distant past. So.
Well, here's the funny thing, too, is, of course, most people haven't read the Odyssey before they watched the movie to listen to us talk to it. So, sorry, guys, but obviously we can recommend you read it. I was reading the Odyssey to keep up with you guys having your conversation, mm-hmm. and I wasn't reading it with as much attention. I wasn't going to talk about it. You know how that changes things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I had enough that I was going, I started thinking about it, and I went, well, wait a minute. When you toss away all the busyness and the funniness and the this and the that, you know, as you say, the Odyssey, it is a tale of homecoming and marriage and what's important to a person and keeping your eye on the prize and being virtuous and all these things, you know, from a Greek point of view, a lot of it, but still. I suddenly said, well, wait a minute, what are we left with in this movie when you take out all that just fun stuff about the Depression, blah, 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 which I'm not even going to go into everything that's wrong with the Depression. I'm not going to the Coen brothers for accuracy, but once you've realized they didn't really ever even stop at that point to go, let me just real quick look at Cliff's Notes or something, then you start going, well, wait a minute, what about the Depression? And so they mashed all this fun stuff to them that mattered about the Depression, like Babyface Nelson, who was never in Mississippi. You know, Pappy O'Daniel, based on a Texas governor and later senator, who went around with that song, You're My Sunshine, and a broom to sweep clean and all this.
So that was something real, huh?
Yeah, but they mashed it into a Louisiana politician who did some of the other things that guy did. And then they put him in Mississippi. And Tom says, I think we see here how history suddenly gets compressed and remembered wrong by everybody.
Huh.
It's just close enough.
Yeah.
And then it gets told that way. And everybody goes, oh, I know all about that. But the thing that got me is I was standing there and I was going, well, then what are we left with? And I was like, we're left with a guy who never learns anything, really. And we're left with, I suddenly started going, I've loved this movie and I still like it. But now I can't like it quite as much. And Tom said, oh my gosh, because he just found Roger Ebert's review.
Mm-hmm.
And so Roger Ebert said, all of these scenes are wonderful in their different ways, and yet I left the movie uncertain and unsatisfied. I saw it a second time, admired the same parts, left with the same feeling. I do not demand that all movies have a story to pull us from beginning to end. And indeed, one of the charms of The Big Lebowski, the Coen's previous film, is how its stoned hero loses track of the thread of his own life, which I didn't like that movie, but that's a different story. But with O Brother, Where Art Thou, I had the sense of invention set adrift, of a series of bright ideas wondering why they had all been invited to the same film.
Hmm.
And once I actually started thinking about the movie, instead of just watching and going, isn't this fun? He described what I was feeling. So it's interesting.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. I can't say I don't feel the same way because watching it, you know, expecting to find all these Odyssey gems and not finding them was disappointing. But I still like the movie.
I do too.
I love the music in the movie. And I guess I do. I am watching it kind of like Roger Ebert, you know, and saying, wow, this section is great and this section is great and this section is great. But I did kind of glom onto the theme of redemption a little bit. How, you know, the old man at the beginning was telling them they were going to find a fortune, but not the one that they were expecting.
Mm-hmm.
And then old Delmar getting baptized. Baptized and saved. Yeah. Right. And also Pete.
And they hung on to it.
Because Ulysses is the only one who remains unaffiliated.
I just loved the way that character talked. His dialogue was just so great. And my husband has never been a George Clooney fan. And he's always says he thinks this character is actually really George Clooney. He says, I think he's just acting like himself.
Yeah.
I remember back when
I saw this the first time, which had to have been very near 2000. I was really struck by George Clooney's acting in this because it must have been that I hadn't seen him like this before this.
I don't think I had either.
Yeah,
had,
so I was amazed and I really enjoyed it. I thought he did such a great job.
Mm-hmm.
The way that he speaks, it reminded me of Raising Arizona, which is a early Coen Brothers movie that I drag out to my family's consternation every now and then. They all roll their eyes and I'm like, but it's Raising Arizona. when I think about Raising Arizona, I think about the music in there, you know, because I think it's like about the first quarter of the movie is almost like a narrated music video almost, you know, where he's Nicolas Cage is just going through all this stuff to bring you up to date to where they
I've
are
seen
now.
It twice, and I only remember one scene, which is which tells you the Coen Brothers just not for me. But it's the thing where they're trying to get the diaper, so he has to go in and hold up the store while she's driving around the block to drop him off, and he's running out throwing diapers in the car, and that stuck with me. But the rest of it, I don't remember all that you're saying. So, what kind of music was it in that movie?
Well,
though?
it was
modern.
No, it wasn't modern. It was very odd. Okay. You know, I can't even. I'm not going to try to sing it, but there's this very specific. There's a very specific piece of music in there that runs through that beginning. Yeah. So, and Holly Hunter was in that one as well.
Right.
She played Ed.
So good.
Yeah. Well, but this movie kind of reminded me of that. I think this is a much better movie than Raising Arizona is. But you could kind of tell that the same people made it. The same people were involved with it. And I had read somewhere, and gosh, I wish I had a link, but that the music was important to the Coen Brothers in this one, and they had actually pretty much worked out the music before they even started filming, which is not typical.
Yeah, T-Bone, is that his name, T-Bone Burnett?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, who loves this old-timey music, and we already loved it, so we were so excited when, you know, oh, get that soundtrack.
Yeah, and that is a soundtrack that I own.
We all could sing along with the original, the Big Rock Candy Mountain. I'm just saying. There's no apple juice coming down those rocks. It is alcohol.
Oh, that's great. That's
the
great.
The hobo song.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so we haven't talked about the movie at all, I guess.
Yeah,
we're just...
not too much. But the opening is, Ulysses Everett McGill and his buddies Pete and Delmar are chained together on a chain gang in, did it say what state they were in?
I think they keep saying Mississippi.
Okay. So they're just kind of, I knew they were in Mississippi later, but all right. So anyway, they escape, Yeah. They probably are the whole time. So they escape from the chain gang and, gosh, it's really hard to talk without spoilers.
They've got to get some treasure.
Yeah,
they're
going to get some treasure.
$1.2 million worth of buried treasure.
That's the plan. Ulysses has talked them into this. He says, hey, let's go after some treasure. So There's a hilarious scene where Ulysses has to explain to him that he's in charge. and that's the thing, you know, I just love, you know, that's the other similarity with Raising Arizona that I didn't mention is the way that Nicolas Cage spoke in Raising Arizona was very distinctive. And it's the same here. Mm-hmm. Ulysses Everett McGill speaks in this certain way that it's just hard not to like it. You know, you just want to keep hearing him talk.
I know. He's a quick talker. In fact, this is very much like I think of Odysseus. He's a fast talker. He's a quick thinker. He's good on his feet, and he will tell any lie that seems fairly probable, has one leg in fact so it can go, and people believe him, generally, you know. And you do see that with Odysseus. But I always got the feeling that was something the Greeks admired because he did it so much, and they go, wow, what a storyteller.
Yeah, and that is something that I didn't pick up on. Ulysses Everett McGill, he thinks a lot of himself, but you know, he seems to treasure this Greek notion that you want to be able to talk people into anything. And he's thinking, well, he ought to be in charge because of that. You know, it has nothing to do with how good a person you are or what you're actually going to do or the fact that you're lying all the time. That makes no difference. It's just how you say it and how you can convince people.
Well, he thinks he's smart.
Yeah, he does. He thinks he's way smart.
And we see he actually really isn't as smart as he could be.
Who elected you leader of this outfit? Well, Pete, I figured it ought to be the one with the capacity for abstract thought. But if that ain't the consensus view, then hell, let's put it to a vote.
Well, and I love I did love the fact about George Clooney that he would play the part and he relished it so much because, you know, the thing where Ulysses is very vain. Mm-hmm. He's always worried about his hair. He's got to have his pomade,
yeah.
Dapper Dan, and his hair nets. Yeah. And he'll wake up. The first thing he says when he wakes up, startled, is my hair. And he kind of grabs at his head, you know. And so I watched this, and I never was really, I didn't care about George Clooney one way or the other, but this made me warm to him. Mm-hmm. Because the other story I know about him from this is he's actually Rosemary Clooney's nephew. And I guess a lot of people, if you're younger especially, I never really listened to Rosemary Clooney, but she was a famous singer in her day. Mm-hmm. One of those belt them out Sophie Tucker, which that's even older, so never mind. But sorry. But anyway, he doesn't actually sing when they, at one point, basically it turns into a road trip. And so it's them encountering all these things as they fight their way past obstacles to get back home in time to get this treasure before the valley is flooded, where it's buried. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they do is to get a little money. They stop at a radio station where they've heard tell that if you sing into a tin can, this guy's going to give you each $10. They're like, what a sap. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, so he's recording them and they go in as the Soggy Bottom Boys.
Yeah.
And I mean, the minute he opened his mouth, we all went, that's Union Station. Because, yes, we're such geeks that we actually had a couple of their albums before this ever came out.
Union Station being a band name?
Yeah.
I honestly don't know who they are. All right, that's cool.
Yeah. It's always Alison Krauss in Union Station. And Alison Krauss will have half the album or songs. And they alternate with, the Soggy Bottom Boy sound, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's them, basically. And we all went, Union Station, oh my gosh. So
that's neat. Yep.
But what we read about George Clooney is he was determined he really wanted to sing.
Mm-hmm.
And he practiced and he got coaching and they tried and tried. And they finally went, we're sorry, it's just not going to work. The other two guys did their own singing on the song they sing by themselves. But that's when I was like, oh, I like the way he threw himself into it.
Yeah. I wonder, do you think, did he do the scene thinking he was going to be recorded, I wonder? Well, normally they would have recorded that in a studio and then he'd just sing it while he's acting, right?
But I wonder if
he knew at that point, because he sure let her rip. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I don't know, because he really threw himself into it. And I know from watching some of the notes on or the extras on Sweeney Todd, I remember Johnny Depp saying, you know, Tim told us all that we could just walk around and mouth the words. And then it turns out that if you're not actually singing, everybody can tell who's watching that you're not really singing, even if they're going to put different, you know, studio stuff over it.
Uh-huh.
So we all had to walk around and sing with our horrible little unamplified voices in front of everybody on the soundstage to get the breathing to look right and everything.
That would be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
For me, no question.
Yeah. Well, he didn't seem thrilled when he was telling the story, you know. So I always
waiting
think
for that to end
I...
up on YouTube or something. It is a testament to all those people on the soundstage that it did not. I'm assuming it did not.
Yeah. Because
I have not seen it.
Oh, Sweeney Todd?
No, I have not seen. Well, I haven't seen Sweeney Todd, but I also haven't seen any behind the scenes stuff show up on YouTube.
No. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
But anyway,
yeah.
I think.
So, and there's a little more. There's another piece of interesting music related. History, quote unquote. Well, it is history, even if it may or may not be true. But the story of Tommy Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, please tell us more about that. You, I did listen to that Radiolab piece that you sent me.
It'll be fresher in your mind than it is in mine. But story is that Robert Johnson is a guitarist who still you'll find new guitarists coming up in bands who still worship the way he played. And he was, you know, a young black man back during the Depression. And he only recorded, I think it's 28 songs or something. And then he died very young. And the story was he couldn't really play very well. And he went away. And when he came back, I met the devil. I went to the crossroads at midnight, met the devil, and sold him my soul for guitar playing skills.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the Radiolab guys decides, I'm going to find out where that story actually came from. And it's an amazing detective story in itself.
Yeah, we'll sure link to that.
Yeah.
So please check the show notes. Radiolab is just terrific.
Because in the movie, you notice they don't pick up Robert Johnson at the crossroads. They pick up Tommy Johnson. And that is the name of the guy that eventually they think probably started telling that story.
Yeah, the Radiolab story talks about both Tommy Johnson and Robert Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And
not related.
Yeah, they're not related at all, but it just seemed that a story morphed into, you know, somebody else's story.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how they tell it. You know, Radiolab, if you haven't heard Radiolab, I highly recommend it.
Oh, yes.
And this is just one of those neat stories. Going to a crossroads, you know, they had an interview with, I believe it was Robert Johnson's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And they played a little piece of that interview in this Radiolab. And, you know, this guy was really old and he's talking about this, you know, as if it was completely true. He went to the crossroads and he said, you got to get there before midnight and you just so you're there when it happens. But then you'll have the opportunity. So fascinating. Yeah.
Well, and in the movie, I liked that they kind of linked to that by the three guys are being pursued by the law because they're escaped convicts.
Yeah.
And the guy who's chasing them, he looks like, you know, a Texas lawman or something, or I guess some Southern lawman. He's got the sunglasses, the hard face, the bloodhound, and he never takes the sunglasses off. And eventually you start getting the feeling that he might not actually be human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he kind of starts making little comments where you suddenly go, what? Hold on. And the description that Tommy Johnson gives sounds like this guy.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he's a nice dresser and he's got a big dog with him. And
somebody Delmar said, what does the devil look like or something like that? And of course, Ulysses knows everything. So he says, well, he's got a bifurcated tail and all this stuff. And then, Tommy says, no, I saw him. He's dresses real nice. And,
no,
and isn't that interesting? You know, that kind of connects to the stand a little bit, you know, with the devil not being who, well, I guess it was the devil's representative really in the stand, but you don't know for sure if that was specifically him or not. But interesting. Yeah, still interesting.
Yeah, not looking mean.
Right.
Just like a regular guy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes me wonder where the images that we have of the devil come from. You know?
Right, I'm thinking about it.
I don't recall anywhere in the Bible where it says he's got a bifurcated tail, just like Ulysses said, you know what I mean?
No.
It's more out of, it came out of artwork.
The idea.
Yeah.
of the serpent, mm-hmm. you know, in yeah. Genesis.
Sure.
And one thing I've read, I think it might have been Robert Alter, I'm not positive, but who said one translation for that also could be kind of like a Chinese-type dragon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess you could take that, and if you're connecting it with a person, you start doing odd things. But I bet it comes from other mythology or folklore of that time, you know, of
yeah,
whatever time period
merging.
That,
yeah.
yeah, those things started showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Where they went, you know, that guy doesn't look great. I could keep that in my mind and be scared of him.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, no question.
Well...
Yep, and then so Ulysses eventually reveals that we're in spoiler territory.
Oh, way
so.
Into spoiler territory. Right.
There is no treasure. He reveals that, and his purpose is really to get to his wife and kids. But you know, you don't know that until the moment he sees his kids singing right. that song. I can't even remember. I can hear it in my head, but I can't remember the words. But
it's down the highway,
yeah.
or is that
yeah,
the last
down the highway? Thing? I think is what yeah. it's called. Yeah. And then, you know, this is what kept sticking in my mind, thinking, you know, yeah, it does have something to do with the Odyssey. Is
mm-hmm.
I love the scene where those three girls and Ulysses talk for the first time in that thing.
Yeah,
because they're explaining to him that his wife has a new. Suitor. He's a suitor, you know, and explaining to him, yeah, he's bona fide. You're not bona fide. You died in a train wreck. Damn it, I did not. Yeah, yeah, I love it.
I'm right here. No, because yeah. you got run over by that train. Mama mm-hmm. said so. Well, and Tom looked up bona fide.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, because we think of it as being authentic, but it yeah. goes a little deeper than that. It's that you've acted in good faith.
Ah.
Bona fides, fidelity.
Gotcha.
And despite the outcome, everything you've done was intended to have, you know, the good, true, honest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when he keeps saying he's not bona fide, you know, he's yeah. like, I am too bona fide. And we're like, and I'm sitting there going, no, you are not. She's right. You're yeah. not, you know, for all the ways that she is Penny, his wife, is mm-hmm. not Penelope, what she is right about is he's not bona fide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's in yep. jail because he forged a lawyer's certificate, right?
Yeah.
And everything he does is to try and cheat his way into stuff. And she asks him to go get her ring. Okay, that does seem like a tough task. But I was thinking about this. Here was my connection to the Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
When Penelope says in the Odyssey that the person who strings Odysseus's bow is the person she's going to marry. And I know there's some uncertainty about whether she knows that's Odysseus or not. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. Because if the only one who can string that bow is Odysseus, what she's saying is I will only be his wife.
Mm-hmm.
No one else can do that.
Yeah.
That's the bona fide part of it, you know. And what Penny is doing is saying that wedding ring to me is what matters. And he never gets that. He's like, well, we'll just buy the one off your fiance who we got rid of. Or, sorry, we're skipping way ahead now.
That's okay.
And yeah. when it comes out of the roll top desk, he doesn't recognize it's not her wedding ring. Shouldn't he know that? I was like, oh my gosh. And I was like, so that's the way to me that Penny was actually like Penelope. She's like, there's one way. This is like stringing the bow.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know?
Interesting.
So it's a very tenuous thing, I realize. But it gave me a certain amount of enlightenment toward Penelope in the mm-hmm. Odyssey.
That's good. Yep. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, one other thing that I thought was really interesting in the movie, not really having to do with the Odyssey, but watching it in the midst of the presidential election or, you know, campaign that we're in.
Yeah.
To have this campaign kind of a farce... cartoonish campaign, which the fact that it reminded me of the presidential campaign is pretty bad, but
hard to avoid thinking about
it's hard
it.
To avoid thinking about it, but yeah, there it's just yeah,
one stunt after another and mm-hmm. then saying bad things about each other.
Yeah, exactly. Is you is or is you ain't my constituency.
We're gonna yeah. sweep clean, because I'm here for the little guy, right?
Yeah.
He sure is, says the, you says know, the midget or dwarf, yeah, or the person that's there, yeah, with the broom.
Yeah, it was funny.
Yeah.
Really funny. And then, you know, what the crowd cares about is the music.
Well, and that, yep, was the other thing about Penelope Penny that showed she really wasn't based on any, you know, Odyssean Penelope, which was that she didn't want to have anything to do with him until, oh, he's in a popular band and everybody likes him.
Mm-hmm.
Then she's interested.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she's smiling and, oh, okay.
That's right.
You know.
Yep.
But the thing I also found interesting, because at one point they go to the movies, they're frustrated. It's just Pete and Delmar, which Delmar, by the way, means from the ocean or of the sea.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Yep.
And Pete's last name was Hogwallop, you know? Mm-hmm. So it made me think of the, isn't it Cersei who turned the people into hogs,
yeah,
pigs?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like there's these little tenuous things. There's not the big story, but the little things are there. But they go to the movies and they're watching, and there's some comedy up there, and they're kind of talking about how we, you know, they think Pete's dead. And I suddenly went, oh, this makes me think of another movie that I've seen a long time ago that has, you know, people going to the movie, because all these convicts come in, they bring them all into the movie. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is like that other movie where the convicts all go to the movie toward the end of it. And sure enough, that movie is called Sullivan's Travels. And it's about a movie director who wants to make a serious movie that's going to show everybody how hard life is and how important things are. And the name of his movie is going to be Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Ah.
And that's where...
That's interesting.
Yeah. Coen Brothers got this, because it's... Sometime we should watch it, although I'm getting ready to drop a couple of spoilers, because in terms of looking at this, because when we looked it up, because I said, well, wait a minute, why did they call this that? That's not from the Odyssey. And so Tom's like, oh, Sullivan's Travels. And I went, oh, because that is, and I got, let's see, that director, Preston Sturgis, who's one of those. He's a name director like Billy Wilder or Frank Capra, but not as big of a name these days. But at the time he was.
Mm-hmm.
He did, well, it doesn't even matter. Sullivan's Travels probably is his most famous one, and most filmmakers know it. But he says, Sullivan's Travels is the result of an urge to tell some of my fellow film writers that they were getting a little too deep dish and to leave the preaching to the preachers.
Hmm.
And he directly mentions Frank Capra several times.
Ah.
That's when I stopped and went, well, now wait, Frank Capra. And I went, oh, you could be right about that. not that I don't love Frank Capra, because everyone does. But the idea is that John L. Sullivan is this director who wants to make this important movie. And so he decides, in order to see what poverty is like, he's going to go out and be poor for a little while.
Hmm.
Well, that kind of blows up in his face. And what happens is he winds up, through a series of circumstances, being convicted of murder. And he winds up on a chain gang in the deep, I think it's the deep south. It's somewhere that seems like it is. And yeah, it is. There's like bayous and horrible places. They're having to do all this stuff. And one of the things that happens is they all get taken to the movies at this local church, where it's comedies that are being shown, cartoons. Mm-hmm. And he's like, that's what I needed, not something to tell me how awful life was. I knew that already. I didn't need to be preached at.
Wow.
And so when I thought about it in terms of that, I was like, well, with the Coen brothers, then does that flip it around? Are they saying it doesn't really matter so much, just have a laugh? Somehow... I don't think they thought about it that deeply. I think they liked the movie and they liked the depression theme, and to them that worked. But it's a valid way to look at it and just say, it doesn't matter if these things are all connected or the story goes nowhere. We wanted a bit of a laugh.
Yeah.
We wanted you guys to have a laugh.
Don't take it so seriously.
Right.
Like me watching it for Odyssey references.
For what?
For Odyssey references. Maybe it was just meant to, just meant for to have fun. Which it definitely was.
Where it's kind of, so it's kind of a mashup of all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know. Yeah. Because he doesn't learn anything. Ulysses learns nothing.
No, nothing at all.
He has one genuine
even after all that stuff, you know, he never did understand why he's going to get the ring. And
Well, and he has one genuine moment where, you know, he's sure he's going to die, and he pops out with this, he drops the fancy language, and it's sincere.
Mm-hmm.
But that's gone.
Yep. That is right. Yeah.
I recommend Sullivan's Travels, by the way.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to watch that. I was looking at it here on IMDb, and again, I'll link to that.
Yeah, it's so old, and it's not like you can't kind of see it coming.
1941, but yeah.
December
1941.
Yeah, it's really, it's old.
Yeah,
and all the
other,
stuff
other
in
things
it is,
going on in December 1941.
Yeah. Funny how that is.
It is, yeah.
But he says, this is the thing that cracks me up. He's in a meeting, I still remember this in my mind's eye, of he's in a meeting with the studio executives, and he says, John Sullivan says, I want this picture to be a commentary on modern conditions, stark realisms, the problems that confront the average man. And the other guy says, but with a little sex in it. John L. Sullivan says, a little, but I don't want to stress it. I want this picture to be a document. I want to hold a mirror up to life. I want this to be a picture of dignity, a true canvas of the suffering of humanity. And the other guy, but with a little sex in it. He says, but with a little sex in it. You know.
Oh, that's great. That is great. Yeah, I can't wait to see that now. I want to, that's neat.
Yeah, because at one point I could swear that, you know, they're talking about Frank Capra, and they keep going, shut up about Capra. And he's like, you know, I want to be like Frank Capra. And he's like, listen, I worked with Capra. You're no Capra. That kind of thing. So it's like, in case we miss it, who's he aiming at here?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
Wow. Yeah.
But I did think it was interesting that the two simpler guys both get saved. And it was just that concept of washed my sins away.
Yeah.
And they don't take it like, I mean, I remember when Delmar comes out and he goes, he washed my sins away and all that stuff I did, it doesn't matter anymore. I'm clean. And the look on Pete's face is so eager.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really genuine. And he goes rushing in, and they don't treat it like a lot of people think you would treat confession or something, you know, on the outside where they're like, oh, yeah, that's easy. Just go and confess it again. They're like, no, that's it. We're saved. We're going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And when Pete is, through fear of death, is telling where the treasure is, he's, oh, God, forgive me for what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
You know, it had an effect on them. They had an internal change of some. They're still, you know, dumb and, you know, not too shaky on right and wrong, but where they understand it, they're trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never really paid attention to that part before.
Yep, and Ulysses was unmoved.
And I never paid attention to that part before. Yeah. At the end, you're thinking, Penelope, you should excuse the expression, hard mm-hmm. ass, you know.
Uh-huh.
But later, I was like, I think she was right.
Mm-hmm.
How is she going to get him to show he has one genuine feeling if he won't carry out one of these things for her?
Yeah.
And again, I'm probably being more Frank Capra-esque about it.
Oh, man.
It is what we do, people. It is what we do.
Oh, you bet. You bet.
And then I have a question for you.
Sure.
Okay, so you say, you know, remember the old blind guy who's supposed to evoke Homer, the blind poet.
Uh-huh.
At the beginning, he says, you'll find treasure, but not the treasure you seek.
Mm-hmm.
So Pete and Delmer do. They get faith.
Mm-hmm.
What about Ulysses? He sees the cow in the place it's not supposed to be, or whatever it was they said about it. That was his, like, oh my gosh, that's supposed to be his light bulb moment. What's his answer to prayer? Because he was always seeking his wife.
Yeah.
Was he supposed to find his faith from that moment, and he just ignores it and walks on?
Yeah, that's what I think. That's what I got out of it.
That's kind of where I was left with it. Is like you found it and you're ignoring it.
Mm-hmm. That's how I felt about it too. And yeah, you know, the way you're describing Ulysses is definitely how I see him. Just not changed throughout the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we did see the one genuine moment, like you said, and yeah. but that was it. Everything else was, you know, the character of Ulysses acting in a way that he thought might impress people.
Right, because one of the best moments of showing that is when the sirens are singing to them, mm-hmm. which is one of the best parts of the whole movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And he starts trying to do his patter to them. And I was like, whoa, what? Yeah. And he gets about half a sentence out, and then he just stops because no one's paying a bit of attention.
Right. Yeah, and he's always, you know, trying to explain himself. You know, he's smarter than everybody, you know, throughout mm-hmm. the entire thing. He's always got the answers whether he actually knows them or not.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's constantly lying all the time, you know.
Well, and the thing, suddenly I'm thinking about, you know, the Coen brothers, and are they making the statement of just have fun or don't? And one of the things that makes me think that maybe they just are mashing it together and they don't really care. They're mm-hmm. just throwing everything at it that they like because it's fun for them, which is fine. Because like I said, I like the movie, but I now think of it differently. Is that, you know how the color is all kind of bleached out, mm-hmm.
yeah.
almost sepia tone, although there's color.
Yeah.
And I always kind of thought that was just the Depression look, you know, it's an old movie. But they say that it was because one of the brothers says, I just love that old Delta look. And because everything when they shot it was super green and lush. So they mm-hmm. had to really jigger the color. And Tom's reading this thing to me about, well, I wanted it to have that Delta look. And I'm like, what? Lots of green vegetation and marshy and kind of jungly. And he's like, yeah, that's what I think of too. Because I guess they haven't spent much time around New Orleans or anywhere. And so I was like, okay, I don't think they think things the way I think things. I don't know if they that word means what they think it means.
Yeah. Oh, funny.
So
Princess Bride.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Another great movie.
I know.
Yep.
I know.
That's right. Oh, well, what else is there to say about this one? Not a heck of a lot, I don't think.
I think we've kind of wrung it dry.
I think we have.
From my notes, anyway.
Yeah, so I definitely recommend it.
Oh, yeah. It's good fun.
Yeah, it's a good time.
And for as far removed as we are from the Depression time, it's almost 100 years ago.
Mm.
Well, you know, what, 85 years ago, something like that. It still evokes enough of a feeling that you look at it and you go, yeah, it feels authentic. So they put Babyface Nelson in the wrong place. So they, you know, mashed this stuff together. It's all true enough in how it's shown.
Yeah.
You know, with the clothes and the cars and the way people are talking and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and you know, I mean, this isn't the kind of movie you'd watch for historical truth anyway. You know, and that is an interesting statement that they are making. I guess I'm starting to have my eyes open just a little bit as to why would they in Fargo say based on a true story when it wasn't?
I know.
And why would they? Well, I guess, you know, what they've done is bona fide with, you know, there is enough of the Odyssey in here to say
yeah,
what they
what
said.
It is.
But then, you know, you're saying with Sullivan's travels that, you know, they're saying don't take everything so seriously. But in Sullivan's travels, it sounds to me like there's another thing going on there where you've got somebody trying to portray this real life, but then they go out to what real life really is and they realize it's not what they're trying to portray even. You know, so there's almost like another message there, but I need to watch it to make sure.
Right. There's several messages going on there about all that stuff, but it's got Veronica Lake in what a lot of people say is her best appearance.
Well, cool.
You know, she's just one of those names that, you know, the starlet who was discovered in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you watch when you see something that says based on a true story, do you watch it differently?
Of course.
I think I do too. So,
and that's,
that's
why they did it.
Yeah, and I think that's why they did it. They did it not trying to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, but to make them watch it differently.
But then don't say that. Then use your craft.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I completely understand what you're saying, because I'm trying to understand it too. Why would they do that? And if they did that trying to deceive everybody and it wasn't, then why are we still watching their movies?
After watching this, this is where I'm like, you know, I don't know if based on the number of things, and this makes me sound awful because I'm like, I'm not watching this for historical accuracy. But when they're saying things like, I did this to get the Delta look. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And I'm going, what is in your mind that's not really connected to anything that I'm thinking about? So then I'm just going, I don't know if you just really liked that movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? How deeply do you guys think about stuff? I'm starting to think you're just kind of like throwing things at it. Like I say, I still like it, but I lose a certain amount of respect for them.
Yeah.
I expect them to get a few things right. I guess they got Tommy Johnson right. But you know what I'm saying?
Sure I do.
If you say you like The Odyssey and then you do a whole movie and you put it at the beginning based on The Odyssey or whatever in tribute to The Odyssey, I expect you to at least try.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that based on a true story thing. For instance, I told you I watched Margin Call. Highly recommended, people. We will be watching it here someday and talking about it. It never said based on a true story. You could tell from watching it, actually, it kind of was based on a true story when you read about it.
Mm-hmm.
If the guy had been thinking about that idea for about a year and a half, and then an event happened in the real world that precipitated him to write it, and it's very much based on a real story. But he used the craft of making the movie to tell the story in such a way, it didn't matter if you knew it was based on a true story or not.
Hmm.
I'm sorry, Coen Brothers. I didn't want to get tough on you, but I had to do it.
Yeah.
I know you can handle it or don't care at all, which is more likely. And probably nobody else does either.
Oh,
but
shoot.
Maybe we need a movie professional to tell us about these things.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't think so. I think you're a movie professional.
Yeah. Thank you. You too, big guy.
Oh, yeah.
Let's both be movie professionals together.
All right. It's time for us to open our own studio.
That's right.
Yep.
We're going to start teaching movie history classes right now.
Right. So. I've got a lot of watching to do.
Well, anyway, it just, it kind of left me with a bad taste in my mouth in terms of, I like the movie, but now, you know, of course, I'm not a fan of theirs, but I did respect them as movie makers.
Oh, that's funny.
More.
Yeah, gotcha.
But, you know, I think they're just kind of like, I've never watched many Quentin Tarantino movies, but I kind of equate them to Quentin Tarantino in terms of, I think he just goes at a project and goes, this is great. This will be fun. And he doesn't worry about, is it the authentic music or this or that? Does it give it the feeling he wants? Yes. Is this dialogue going to just make him happy? Because that's Quentin Tarantino. It just goes on and on and on because he loves language, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've only seen Jackie Brown, but I've listened to Quentin Tarantino. I don't know why I'm fascinated by him, but there you go.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question that I've asked myself, too. I am nowhere near a Quentin Tarantino expert, but I've seen probably 3 or 4 of his movies.
Okay.
And at the end of them, ultra violent, you know, just, but mesmerizing. And at the end of them, I constantly ask myself, what was it about that I enjoyed? And it's almost disturbing that I did, you know? And,
That exciting,
you know, there's a little
crush.
Bit of that feeling in Fargo, but Fargo to me, I really liked it. I liked the whole story of Fargo, but,
well, I love Frances McDormand.
Oh, she's terrific.
She's wonderful.
Terrific.
And Bill Macy is wonderful. And I actually did see Fargo now that I think about it. Did not enjoy it.
Yeah.
But that's, like I say, they just don't click for me. That's, you know, I realize it's me and not them in terms of popularity. Yeah. So, but go ahead.
But yeah, but not Fargo as much, but Fargo a little bit had some of that stuff going on in it. But the, you know, why do people like Tarantino so much? And you know, what is it? Why do we want to see that?
He hooks into pop culture, I think, in a way that's, I mean, he just loves pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it shows in everything he does. He's super intense about it. There was a BBC special that I got via radio downloader, and it's Quentin Tarantino's Jukebox. And it's this two-part, I think, so maybe 2 hours of him talking and his music person, because he's got a dedicated music person, and, you know, whoever the BBC person is who was talking to them about the music that he uses in the movies and how he picks it and some of the music that he chose. And so they're playing all these pieces of music. And I mean, Quentin Tarantino, he was there for most of that 2 hours talking about the music. And just there's something about his personality. He's very charismatic for a strange looking guy who makes violent movies that I'm kind of afraid to watch. Which is why I really don't watch many of them, or I've watched one. I'd love to watch Kill Bill, but I'm afraid of it. I used to watch Alias when it was good, the first season or two, guys, okay? But he was on that as a guest, and he was just this weird looking little guy, but there was something about him, you just kept watching him. And so I guess that comes through in his movies.
Yeah, I think that it does.
And there's something, is it stylized violence, though?
Very. Sometimes it's done for humor. Yeah, it's very stylized. You know? Yeah. And Robert Rodriguez is another one. He's kind of a, I think he's a Tarantino disciple or something. Because it seems to me that Tarantino helped him along. But
they did that Grindhouse thing, right? That two movie thing that went together.
That I'm not sure.
Years ago.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it was that like doesn't sound familiar to me.
It was like two movies that were like horror type movies, but they both ran together always. It was like going to an old style double feature. And they each did movies just for that, and they made up fake trailers for it. And Robert Rodriguez's movie, from one of the trailers, wound up being the movie about the like Hispanic, like the lawn guy, the yard care guy, who goes on a rampage, and it's a horror movie.
Yeah.
Sorry, a lot of vague references.
Well, the one of the movies that Robert Rodriguez did is Desperado, and I've seen that a couple times.
Is that the first one he did that they redid?
It's El Mariachi was the first one, and. Okay. And then Desperado is kind of a sequel to it.
Okay.
But Antonio Banderas was in it, not the original El Mariachi guy.
I saw the original, but not the... We might have watched the Antonio Banderas, and I was like, other than the looks of this one guy, there's not that much different.
You know, I think Tarantino was in Desperado.
Was he?
I think that he was. I think he played a tiny part.
I think they're pals.
Yeah, I think so, too. But yeah, I just don't, you know, I watch those. I haven't seen one of those films for a long time, but, you know, whenever I would finish watching one, I would go, wow, what was it about that? Mm-hmm. What was it? And you may have nailed it. I don't know. But they're just very watchable and very violent.
Well, yeah, there's that certain kind of excitement of that kind of thing. And that's, well, you know, and think about... there's a lot of that in those superhero movies, like the Avengers.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's comic book eyes, so you kind of can almost a lot of times see the biff from the cow. So it's not so bad. Right. But yeah. I was thinking of just, you know, that horrible shooting at the Batman movie.
Yeah.
And I thought, how ironic, because of any of those movies, Christopher Nolan is probably, I would say, the most moral message guy of any of them. His movies always come back to personal responsibility and, you know, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, they do.
And then some psycho goes off on the wrong tangent.
Yeah.
But
that he did. Terrible.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, sorry, I didn't mean to bring that up. But I was just thinking it was ironic that that's what fostered it.
It is.
You know.
Yep.
But, you know, there's no telling what crazy people are going to latch onto, I have to say.
Yeah, that's for certain.
So
that's for certain.
Yeah, well, I don't have a very violent movie in the future.
Well, that's
good. Probably some on my list.
There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. So what have we got next? In 2 weeks, we're doing... Go ahead.
What is it? Let's see.
It's the Uncommon Reader, by Alan Bennett.
Yes.
I have that in my possession, ready to read.
HRH, Her Royal Highness, and a bunch of books.
All right.
Luckily, though, it's quite short.
So, after the stand.
It might not sound great, but give it a try because it is quite a great little book.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great. And then you picked a movie today.
Oh, I did. I picked a movie, Mary and Max.
And this is a movie I've never heard of, and I just did a tiny bit of research, and I'm really excited to watch it. Sounds great.
I had never heard of it, and then I was at the video store with Rose, and she just plucked it off the shelf and went, here's one I've heard of, and then I watched, and I think we should all watch it. And we watched it, and I was like, I've never seen a movie like this exactly. And it's animated. It's an adult animated movie, but not adult. It's just, you know, not for kids. But it's by turns funny like you would expect animation to be, but then it gets real lifey on you. It's about is she 8 or 12? A young girl who, in Australia or New Zealand, who begins to be a pen pal with a 40-year-old recluse in New York City. And it's about their relationship through the letters and their lives as you see them, waiting for and sending letters. And it sounds terrible now that I say this, but, you know, it's impossible to describe, really. Impossible to describe, but it's really a unique movie.
Great. It's available Netflix streaming for those of you who have Netflix.
Is it?
Okay. It is. So. Okay. That's great.
I do not, but maybe it's on Amazon Prime streaming. I'll have to look.
Yeah.
So.
Well, great.
And then, can I give the early heads up?
Sure.
Let's see. So, what are we talking about now? November?
Oh, yeah.
You do a book in October.
Right.
Movie.
Which I have not selected yet, but I'm close.
The next book I'm going to do after The Uncommon Reader. So we got a couple of months, people. But I'm talking about Bleak House by Charles Dickens. And I can hear the screams going out across the land right now. Because, you know, if you thought Steinbeck at 600 pages was bad, and I did, I am retaliating and upping it with 822 pages of Charles Dickens. Oh, yeah.
All right.
So I'm just putting this out there so people can start now. Because here's the thing. When you read the description, it says it's a mystery. It's a commentary on law. It's a romance. It's a comedy. It's all these things. And I'm like, oh, right. So I start reading and I find out, oh, my gosh, it is all those things. Plus, I would say it's kind of a horror story in a way, too. And I can't put the dang thing down.
Wow.
I'll be reading some modern book and I'll go, oh, yeah, that was fine. Oh, I'm done. Oh, good. Now I can get back to Bleak House.
Fantastic. I just looked it up on Wikipedia. It says it was published in 20 monthly installments between March 1852 and September 1853.
Yeah, excellent. I have to say, the thing about Dickens is since he was writing for publications like that, you know, you got plenty of cliffhangers and hooks in there because he had to keep people interested from month to month.
Yeah.
But wow, yeah,
20 months. That's cool.
Right. Oh, detective fiction, romance, melodrama, and satire. And I have to say, this book, there's one character in here who you do not expect it, but she is self-aware and makes these little comments in a way that strike me as being very modern. It's a very interesting book.
Oh, great. Well, I look forward to it.
Okay, well.
That is good.
You're so chipper about that. That's great. That's super.
Yay. Just wait till we're off the air. Wait a minute.
I know. Then the yelling will begin.
So. Right. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah, thanks.
And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Right. With The Uncommon Reader.
That's right. Yeah. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.